Welcome to Sunday Civics, the show for the civically engaged. I'm your host and civics teacher, Eljoy Williams, and on today's episode, we'll feature my interview with the author, Richard Rothstein, about his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This book is the first pick for our Civic Book Club and gives a detailed analysis of the history of housing segregation and breaks down how the policies and laws enacted by local, state, and federal government help support this practice. But before we get to the interview, I want to invite you to sign up and join in on the Civic Book Club. Each book is handpicked by me and connects directly to the topics we discuss on the show. By participating, you can expand your worldview and take your civic education to the next level. We read the book together and then connect online to have a discussion. It's simple and free to join. Visit the website at sundaycivics.org and click the Civic Book Club tab. Grab the latest title we're reading and engage with others in the Sunday Civics community. If you're a civic patron and support the show financially, you even get to join in on interviews with the authors we talk to live. Visit our website at sundaycivics.org to learn more.
All the wahala, all the problems, all the things that you think that you must do to start in this world. Like when the teacher, schoolboy, and schoolgirl come together.
Richard is a research associate for the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's also a fellow at the Haas Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a leading authority on housing policy, and the book is essential reading for understanding housing policy in the United States. And just like for every guest, we begin each conversation asking our guest, what was your first civic action?
Well, you're asking me to remember a long, long time ago. But as I think back, I think probably the first action I actually took was picketing a Woolworths store in support of the North Carolina lunch counter sit-in group, protesting the segregation of public facilities in the South. And as I recall, that was 1961.
Wow. Yeah. A lot of people, when we ask that question and they try to think back, it's a bit of a chore.
So we don't ask many people who have to think back as far as I have to.
Well, we did have someone who matched you, Dr. Lester Young, who was one of our first guests. He went to school in the South from New York. But he was too young, they said, to participate in the sit-in. But he participated in the practices. So you have someone that matches you there.
Okay. Almost.
Almost. So your book, The Color of Law, was our first pick for our Civic Book Club. And one of the things that I tell our audience is that it's important to understand the history and context of an issue, particularly if you're going to take action on it. So your book gives a very detailed analysis of the history of housing segregation in this country, and specifically how local and state governments created policies and laws that actually forced segregated communities. Why, in your view, is it important to know and understand the history and the origins of these policies?
Well, this history is actually more important to know than most histories, which are interesting, but don't affect what we're permitted or not permitted to do. But in this case, we have a national myth that has prevented us from attempting to desegregate neighborhoods in metropolitan areas all across the country. We began desegregating facilities in the mid-1930s. We desegregated law schools first, and then colleges and universities, and then in Brown versus Board of Education. We desegregated the schools, elementary and secondary schools, and then the civil rights movement came along and we passed laws prohibiting segregation and lunch counters and in water fountains even, and buses and public accommodations. But we've left untouched the biggest segregation of all, which is that every metropolitan area in this country is residentially segregated. There are clearly defined areas where blacks and whites live. The reason that we've left it untouched is because we've adopted a national myth. And the myth is shared by both liberals and conservatives, by blacks and by whites. And that myth is that all the segregation that we see around us in where people live happened by accident. We call it de facto segregation. We think that unlike the other segregations that we abolished in the mid-20th century, this one was all created by individual private activities, not government-sponsored, unconstitutional, because the government wasn't involved in it. It was just private choices and prejudice. People like to live with each other of the same race, or private homeowners refused to sell to African-Americans in white neighborhoods, or maybe black families just didn't have enough money to move into middle-class communities. All of these individual decisions created racial segregation. And what the Supreme Court has said is that if racial segregation was created by individual personal decisions, by accident, in effect, without government design, then there's nothing we're permitted to do anything about. We're not permitted to do anything about it. But if racial segregation was created by the government with explicit policies that were intended to make sure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another, then the Supreme Court says we have an obligation to remedy it. So because we've adopted a myth that says that racial segregation happened without government involvement, we're powerless to do anything about it. If we understood this history, we would understand that we have an unconstitutional system of residential segregation, that it requires a remedy, it requires us to desegregate if we want to be faithful to our constitutional responsibilities. So the history, knowing the history, is critically important. It determines whether we are or are not permitted to desegregate.
And that's important because, you know, I think, as you said, it's something that everybody believes, right? So it's not just white America, but those of us who, some of us who are advocates, it's a myth that we've adopted. And by knowing the history and knowing that now the government actually has a responsibility, it's not up to private institutions or individuals, but that the government has a responsibility, and that could be the local, the state, and the federal government in order to remedy these issues. Now, I was surprised by, while reading the book, that some of the communities, just going into the history of this, where segregated housing projects and the suburb developments that were built were not pre-existing segregated communities. And it made me think of, you know, my family, when they migrated from the South, North Carolina, up here to Brooklyn, New York. And then once they began to buy homes, they went out to a neighborhood here in Queens called Rosedale. And Rosedale and Laurelton, you know, when they bought their homes, they always talked about it was predominantly a mixed ethnic community. So where my grandmother and my grandfather bought their house, there was also a Jewish family, and there was also, you know, a Greek family, and there was a Pakistani family. There was sort of a mixed development. And then they noticed that development started coming up in different areas that kind of split the suburban, you know, into a suburban, mainly all white community. And then, you know, housing developments that sort of formed, you know, Jamaica and the, you know, quote, ghetto, or black neighborhoods, I should say. So I was surprised by that was this commonplace, that these projects were built and actually forced segregation?
Yes, it was unfortunately a commonplace. We would be stunned if we were transported back to the mid-20th century or early 20th century to see the extent to which there was residential integration. Just noticed the other day, I read an obituary in the newspaper of Linda Brown, the young girl in Topeka, Kansas, who was Her father was the plaintiff in the Brown versus Board of Education case. And the obituary described how she grew up in an integrated neighborhood, but she still had to go to a segregated school. I don't know if you've read, or maybe some of your listeners have read, the autobiography of the great African-American novelist, poet, playwright, Langston Hughes. Mm-hmm. He describes how he grew up in his autobiography in an integrated Cleveland neighborhood. We don't think of downtown Cleveland as being integrated, but he grew up in the early 20th century in a downtown Cleveland neighborhood. He says his best friend was Polish. He says he dated a Jewish girl. This was not unique. I'm not suggesting that every community was integrated. It wasn't. But it was commonplace. And the reason it was commonplace is because working class families didn't have automobiles in those days. And so they needed to be able to walk to work or take short streetcar rides. And most jobs were concentrated in downtown areas, factories, and other workplaces. So workers had to live close enough to be able to walk to work. And if you had factories where there were Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants and Jewish immigrants and African Americans all working in the same factories, they had to live in the same neighborhoods. So Langston Hughes describes this neighborhood. It was an integrated neighborhood. It's actually called the Central Neighborhood of Cleveland. And in the 1930s, the Public Works Administration, a New Deal agency, demolished integrated housing in that neighborhood to create two separate projects, one for African Americans and one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation that otherwise would not have existed in Cleveland, or certainly wouldn't have been as forceful. And this happened in many places, even in the South. Many places, many institutions were segregated, as we mentioned before. You had segregated water fountains and segregated buses and segregated lunch counters. But there were integrated neighborhoods for the same reason. People had to live close enough to their workplaces to get to work. And there was a neighborhood in Atlanta called the Flats, which was an integrated neighborhood, about half white, half black, much like the Central Neighborhood in Cleveland, where Langston Hughes grew up. And the Public Works Administration demolished integrated housing in the Flats in Atlanta, built a segregated project for whites only, forcing the African Americans who were displaced to double up with relatives and find overcrowded housing elsewhere, and contributing to the degradation of the African-American community. In a liberal place, we think of a liberal place like Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is a symbol of liberalism in this country. Mm-hmm. But the area around MIT, the Central Square neighborhood, was an integrated neighborhood, also about half black, half white. The Public Works Administration demolished housing in that neighborhood, and the federal government built two separate projects, one for African Americans and one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation in the Boston metropolitan area that otherwise wouldn't have existed. So I'm not suggesting that every community in the country was integrated, but it was certainly not unusual to have integrated neighborhoods. And in many of these, the government created segregation by building public housing that separated whites from blacks who previously lived together.
So let's expound, go on a little bit further, because it's not only the government sort of building these projects that forcefully put people in different buildings based upon race, but there was also a climate that was created in order to seek approval for these projects. So let's talk about the use of racial animus and combine that with economic anxiety that was used to wedge communities to promote segregation, that it was a necessity. In your opinion, why was this so successful then and still successful, I think, to today?
Well, let me begin by saying that nobody should suggest that there wasn't a lot of racial prejudice in the country. The government policies that created segregation were popular among most of the white community, not all of it, but most of it. But that's not no excuse for the federal government's policies, because the Bill of Rights exists for the explicit purpose of requiring the government to ignore popular prejudices in order to protect the civil rights of all Americans. So there was certainly a prejudice, but the government caved into that prejudice in violation of the Constitution and created segregated neighborhoods. For example, in the South, for example, and when the Brown versus Board of Education decision that desegregated schools, of course, whites liked segregated schools, but nobody thinks today that the fact that it was popular to segregate schools among the white population was a reason not to find that segregated schools were unconstitutional. And by the same token, the fact that neighborhood segregation may have been popular among some whites is not an excuse for the federal government to have segregated neighborhoods and reinforced and created that prejudice. I mentioned before the Atlanta example, where the Public Works Administration demolished integrated neighborhood and built a project for whites only, mm-hmm. forcing the African Americans who lived there into more deteriorated conditions. This happened all over the country. African Americans were crowded into downtown neighborhoods by public policy, and their neighborhoods became slums. Whites looked at these neighborhoods. They assumed that African Americans were slum dwellers. They didn't understand that the slum conditions were not created by the people, but by the actions of government that forced African Americans into concentrated areas of disadvantage. And so they didn't want African Americans to move into their neighborhoods because they would bring these slum conditions with them, not understanding, as I say, that the slum conditions were a function of public policy and not of the people. I'm not suggesting that this was the only reason
right.
that whites didn't want African Americans moving into their neighborhoods, but government reinforced it and expanded it and made it much more intense. And if we had different policies, in the examples I gave you before, it would have been possible to build integrated housing, for example, in Langston Hughes's Cleveland neighborhood or in Cambridge or in Atlanta. There may have been some whites who wouldn't have wanted to live in an integrated building, even though they'd lived in an integrated neighborhood before. But there was an enormous housing shortage. And for every white who didn't want to move into a building because it was integrated, there were 10 families who would have been happy to take their place.
Right.
So this was a completely unnecessary policy, and it created and reinforced not only segregation itself, but attitudes of discrimination that otherwise would not nearly have been so popular.
It reminds me also just of the stigma that public housing has today, right? When you think of public housing or projects as the words, you know, are used to describe them, you think about them being run down, being dirty, being violent and things of that nature. And then if you, you know, organize or sort of know anything about working with tenants and building associations, you know that they are consistently asking for repairs. They're consistently asking for, you know, help in terms of cleanup and all of that. And it doesn't ever reach that level. So it's sort of, you know, the management and sort of the lax repairs and other things sort of continue to create that environment that then has that reputation.
Well, actually, you're right. Absolutely right. And it goes deeper than that. Public housing that I was describing before was not for poor people. When it first started in this country in the 1930s, the projects that I described in Cleveland or Cambridge or Atlanta or many, many other places were not for poor people. They were for working class families, segregated, but black and white working class families who had jobs. You couldn't move into public housing if you were poor. You had to demonstrate a good employment record to live in public housing. The only reason that public housing became a place for poor people is because the federal government, and we can talk about this later, embarked on a program to move whites out of public housing into family homes in the suburbs, and prohibit African Americans from doing the same. At about the same time that this happened in the late 1940s and 1950s, industry left the cities. They moved into suburbs, into rural areas. So there were fewer and fewer jobs available for the increasingly black population of public housing projects. They became poorer and poorer. Eventually, public housing came to be subsidized. That is, people couldn't afford to rent the apartments any longer. It was no longer a pay-for-itself program as it had started out as. It was now a subsidy program for poor people. Once the program came to be subsidized, the government stopped maintaining it well and stopped investing in it. It wasn't collecting enough money in rent, and it required public subsidies, public appropriations. So the maintenance declined, upkeep declined, and public housing became a much more deteriorated institution than it was when it began.
And it wasn't only, you know, you talk about those intersections, it kind of opens your mind. And as, you know, going through the pages of you using example after example all across the country. And for those who've read the book and we've been communicating back and forth that have lived in those developments, lived in those communities, there's sort of this eye opening, or at least this exhale that says, oh, we weren't crazy, you know, and people and saying that there was something here that they couldn't quite put their finger on that was happening, that was the reason why their community was structured the way it was, or that they couldn't get the support that they needed, or, you know, things of that nature. And so there was some collective sigh of relief for some of our readers who are from some of the areas that you listed in the or talked about in the book, that they weren't crazy, that there was something, you know, that was set in place, or some plan set in place that wasn't set up for, you know, Black families to succeed.
No, they weren't crazy at all. And in fact, this also goes a bit deeper. Once the projects became projects for poor people, when they were no longer projects for working class families, prior to that time, there were many maintenance workers who actually lived in the projects that they were taking care of. They had good jobs as maintenance workers. They worked for the public housing authorities, and they lived in the projects, and they took care of the projects. They had pride in the places in which they lived. Once this became a project for poor people, people who had good jobs were evicted. And the maintenance workers were no longer permitted to live in the projects because their incomes were too high for the cutoff of projects that now became places for poor people and were previously places for working class families. So when maintenance workers no longer lived in the projects where they were working, that was another reason that maintenance declined. The maintenance workers, there were fewer of them. Fewer maintenance workers were hired because the subsidies that were required to maintain the projects were draining public funds. And the people who did maintain them no longer had pride in them because it weren't the places that they lived.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Can you just to talk about some of the additional players in this, you know, in looking in the history, can you expand upon how religious institutions, as well as the forming of 501c3 or neighborhood associations and organizations, were also complicit in maintaining the segregation?
Another unconstitutional action that the federal government took was to use the IRS's tax exemption authority to grant tax exemptions to religious institutions, to hospitals, to universities that took aggressive steps to segregate the neighborhoods in which they were operating. The example I give in my book is the University of Chicago, where the office of the president of the University of Chicago, he was president, Robert Hutchins, was president of the University of Chicago from the late 1930s until the early 1950s. And he had an office whose job it was, a team of lawyers, whose job it was to sue to have African-Americans evicted from homes around in the environs of the University of Chicago, because the homes in that area were covered by neighborhood agreements prohibiting resale to African-Americans. Mm-hmm. Of course, those agreements rarely lasted, because African-Americans, being so overcrowded in dense downtown neighborhoods, were willing to pay much more for housing than whites were willing to pay for similar housing. And so it was the interest of a white family to sell to an African-American because they would get a much higher price for their home from an African-American than they would for a white. So in these neighborhoods around the University of Chicago and other places like that, there were frequently cases where white families, despite these neighborhood agreements, would sell a home to an African-American. And then the University of Chicago lawyers would sue to have them evicted because they had bought it in violation of this compact in the neighborhood. Well, the IRS had no business maintaining the tax exemption for the University of Chicago. This was not a hidden activity. It was out in the open. It was explicit. Subsequent IRS decisions in other areas have made clear that the IRS violates the Fifth Amendment and the IRS code when it extends a tax exemption to institutions that are racially discriminatory in their fundamental purpose. So this is another case of where had the government followed the Constitution, obeyed the Bill of Rights, and told the University of Chicago that unless you stop this, we're going to pull your tax exemption, this would have had an enormous impact, not just on the University of Chicago, but on all the other institutions in the city of Chicago and around the country
right.
that were engaged in similar practices. It would have only taken one or two cases like that to send a message. No church. Many churches were involved in this activity. Many of them were ethnic churches, you know, Polish churches and Italian churches and Irish churches, where the priests wanted to keep their congregations living in a homogenous neighborhood around the church. So they were the leaders in promoting segregation in those neighborhoods. But the churches are desperately dependent on their tax exemptions. And all it would have taken was the IRS lifting the tax exemption of one or two institutions, and these practices would have ended.
Right, right. It makes me think of, you know, in the early part of the Bush administration when they were, you know, even the rumor of investigating religious institutions and churches based upon their tax status and were they being, you know, too political. And, you know, everyone was fearful of even doing something as basic as voter registration drives. You know, or having electeds visit. And so that immense power of just even the rumor of the federal government investigating or calling someone's tax exempt into question does have significant power. You know, one of the other things that was just completely flabbergasted that there were, as you mentioned, Supreme Court cases, right, that were decided and, you know, held and local not only Supreme Court, but also just state court cases and local governments and state governments just outright defied them with their policies and laws. I didn't think that was possible. I mean, I know it's possible, but, you know, it was just in blatant disregard in some of the descriptors that you have in the book of the agencies doing things that they know and that they said was, you know, in defiance of these court rulings.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't have an army. And if the administration is not willing to enforce civil rights, then the Supreme Court can issue as many decisions as it wants. And the civil rights won't be observed. And this is no surprise to us. We've seen this in school desegregation cases in the South. In Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, the Supreme Court said that school segregation was unlawful. But it didn't, the next day, schools didn't become desegregated. The states embarked on massive resistance to the order. State officials evaded the order, maintained segregated schools. The same thing happened in the area of housing.
Right.
In 1917, the Supreme Court said it found in a case involving Louisville, Kentucky, that a city couldn't maintain an ordinance which designated which areas whites could live in and which areas blacks could live in. There were many cities that adopted such ordinances. Actually, the ordinances would have been completely unnecessary if it weren't for the fact that many of these communities in the South were integrated in residential. Even if they were segregated in other institutions, their neighborhoods were integrated. And many of the cities like Louisville and Baltimore and others like that passed ordinances trying to get whites out of black neighborhoods and blacks out of what they thought were white neighborhoods. The Supreme Court found that the cities couldn't have these ordinances in 1917, but many of them had them up until 1950. So the court's orders depend on public support to be enforced. And that's why knowing this history is so important, because unless we develop a new commitment to civil rights and an understanding of the unconstitutional nature of residential segregation, even if we were successful in pursuing court cases to order the government to take steps to desegregate. For example, if we had court cases where the courts ordered the suburbs to repeal their zoning ordinances that prohibited townhouses from being built in the community or apartments or single family homes as a way of keeping out minority families. Even if we had those court orders, suburbs wouldn't obey them unless there was an administration willing to enforce it.
Right. Right. Well, let's move on to present day. What are some of the things that state and the federal government is doing to perpetuate housing segregation in America today?
Well, do you mind if I go back a minute before we go to the present day?
Because sure.
I want to talk about one other policy. It was perhaps the most important policy that the federal government used to create segregation. And I think it's necessary to understand that policy before we move on to the present. So may I describe that to you for a minute?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. There was another agency of the New Deal, the Federal Housing Administration, which embarked on a program to move white families out of cities into all white suburbs of single family homes. This was an explicitly racial program. And I'm sure you're familiar with many of the suburbs that the FHA created. They created hundreds of them.
Yes.
Places like Levittown, east of New York City, maybe you remember hearing Pete Seeger sing a song of by Malvina Reynolds about little boxes on a hillside made of ticky-tacky, and they all look the same. That was about a suburb that the Federal Housing Administration created south of San Francisco. Hundreds and hundreds of these developments. Someone like Levitt in Levittown, east of New York City. Mm-hmm. Could never have assembled the capital on his own to build 17,000 homes. That's how big Levittown was, 17,000 homes. He couldn't find the capital to build that kind of development. The only way he could do it was by going to the Federal Housing Administration, submitting his plans for the development. The plans had to include, by Federal Housing Administration requirement, a commitment never to sell a home to an African American. The Federal Housing Administration required Levitt and all of these other builders across the country to include a clause in their deeds that prohibited resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans.
Mm.
And this is why the public housing projects that we talked about before became all black, because the whites were given incentives by the federal government to move out of the projects, and the African Americans were prohibited from doing so. White families could move out of public housing. And remember, before the later period, before 1950 or so, or 50s, public housing was self-supporting. People were paying rent in public housing. White families could move out of public housing and into single-family homes in all white suburbs like Levittown and pay less than their monthly housing costs than they were paying for rent in public housing. That's how enormous the subsidy was.
Hmm.
Well, the Federal Housing Administration had a manual. This was an open, explicit racial policy. It was not something that was hidden. It wasn't something that rogue bureaucrats did. It was a manual of the Federal Housing Administration that prohibited the sale of these homes to African Americans. It even prohibited the financing developments that were close to African American neighborhoods, because the manual said they ran the risk of quote, infiltration of incompatible racial elements. There's one case I describe in my book where a developer in Detroit wanted to build a suburb. It was for all whites, a subdivision for all whites. It wasn't going to be integrated, but the Federal Housing Administration refused to guarantee his bank loans unless he built a 6-foot-high, half-mile-long concrete wall.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, separating the development of white homes from the African-American neighborhood. So this was an explicit racial policy. The white families who bought those homes, they were very inexpensive. Levittown homes in the mid-20th century cost about $100,000 in today's money, inflation adjusted. Today, they sell for $500,000.
Wow.
The white families who moved into those homes gained over the next couple of generations $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 in equity, in wealth. This is the way any families in this country gain wealth, except for the very wealthiest families, is from the equity in their homes. The white families who gained this wealth used it to send their children to college. They used it to take care of medical emergencies or economic emergencies, unemployment, and to bequeath the wealth to their children, who could use it for down payments on their own homes. Today, African American incomes are about 60% of white incomes on average. African American wealth is about 10% of white wealth on average. And that enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that we've never remedied. And the wealth gap is the most important contributor to the ongoing racial inequality in all areas of life that we have in this country today. So this is an unconstitutional housing system which has had enormous ongoing effects. And I just want to mention that one policy because it created the white suburbs that surround every metropolitan area in the country. And it's primarily responsible for the ongoing segregation that we continue to experience.
That's really important because, you know, quite often in conversations about the wealth gap, there is someone always brings up, well, you had the same opportunities or your families had the same opportunities as mine did. And that's not the case. The case is that, you know, my grandparents or, you know, my father or others did not have the same opportunities, both financially and now in even the projects or the housing that was available. They did not have the same opportunity to be able to financially invest in owning a home. And when we're thinking of some of the barriers that exist today for my generation in being able to afford the affordability of owning a home, there is this huge disparity. And a lot of it has to deal with not sort of having the wealth, you know, and the experience, and also the way that our communities are structured and that huge gap that exists, that we are running behind.
But the thing to remember and the most important message that I have for you is that this wealth gap was a government creation.
Yeah.
It was an explicit government creation.
That's
it
really
not
important.
Something that happened. Yeah, go on. I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying that's really important to point out because we, you know, and quite often we internalize and say that, well, if we had just, you know, paid our bills on time, but what happens when you do? What happens when you pay your bills on time? What happens if you get the good job? What happens, you know, if you save all your money and yet you are still not able to have access to a project because the government specifically prevented you from having the same access as somebody else just based upon race?
That's correct. Yeah. Mm.
So let's move on because the other conversation that is happening today that, you know, I can say I live in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, and it is an ongoing conversation here. I don't know if you're familiar. There's another book that, you know, talks a little bit about my neighborhood, The Battle for Bed-Stuy. And gives a history of the Bedford-Stuyvesant community, talks about poverty in New York City, the creation by the Kennedys of the Bedford-Stuyvesant restoration, and sort of the home ownership that was built here in Bedford-Stuyvesant from a previously integrated community to now a primarily African-American or people of color and Caribbean. To now, because of the buzzword today of gentrification, that ownership is now switching again. And so I want to clarify, and, you know, with you being an expert, maybe you can clarify this for us, is what the actual definition of gentrification is, because it means different things to different people. You know, I've attended a number of different workshops and community groups, and, you know, everybody has this definition, but as an expert in the field, how would you define gentrification?
Well, let me first say that I'm not an expert in the field. I'm a historian of this. and, you know, the experts in the field are the housing experts, not me. But I will say gentrification is typically, the term is typically used to describe a process whereby middle-class families, mostly white, but not only white, move into neighborhoods that are in central cities, that are access to jobs and transportation and other amenities. They bid up the housing prices in those central city areas as they buy up apartments and homes. As they bid up the housing prices, the property taxes increase, making the community unaffordable even to homeowners who live there for a long time. Landlords raise rents or convert the apartment buildings to condominiums, also forcing the African-American population out. That's typically, I think, what's meant by gentrification. I think the important thing to remember is that this is not a new phenomenon. It's just a new word.
Mm.
Gentrification is really no different from what we used to call 40, 50 years ago, urban renewal. And there used to be a phrase for urban renewal that the policy experts and advisors used and community leaders used. They said urban renewal means Negro removal.
Wow.
And this gentrification is no different from that. It's and what happened was that, we're familiar with many of these. I'm sure you're familiar with many of these urban renewal projects that took place in the 20th century that demolished neighborhoods where African Americans lived and forced them to move into new segregated neighborhoods elsewhere. St. Louis, for example, I'm sure you've seen pictures, if you haven't been there, of the Gateway Arch, the sort of half a McDonald's sign that's up on the Mississippi River. Blocks and blocks of St. Louis were demolished to build that arch of African-American homes and African-American neighborhood. And the African-Americans who were displaced from their homes because of that moved to the one of the very few places that would accept them, because there was housing, there were policies in other areas that prohibited them from moving. And the only places that could accept them were places like Ferguson, which is why Ferguson became a predominantly African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today, gentrification is doing the same thing. It's destroying the ability of many low-income minority families to live in the communities where they have lived. But instead of permitting them to move into high-opportunity neighborhoods throughout the metropolitan area, it simply shifts them to new segregated neighborhoods, sometimes in inner ring suburbs, sometimes with even longer and more difficult commutes to the jobs that they have. And this is a policy failure. Many of the groups that advocate for low-income families focus on the importance of preserving a share of housing in these gentrifying communities for low and moderate-income families. Making sure that developers have to set aside a share of their units for low-income families and so forth. But that's only half the story. Even if, and it's a big if, even if we were able to preserve a share of housing in these communities for the people who used to live there, most of them would be displaced. And what we should be focused on is the fact that they're being displaced to newly segregated suburbs elsewhere. And we do not have the kinds of policies then enable them to integrate the broader metropolitan area and live in communities where there are good jobs and access to transportation and other amenities of middle-income communities. So we need to do two things to fight gentrification. One is to preserve a share of housing for the existing population. But the second, and perhaps even more important, is to ensure that the people who are inevitably displaced have a good place to go rather than simply a new segregated neighborhood.
Hmm. Now, moving on to you have a section towards the end of your book in terms of considering some fixes. And there isn't, you know, at least to my knowledge, there isn't one thing that can be done to fix all of this. Am I correct?
There are many things.
There are many, but not one magic bullet thing that can be done.
There are lots of ones. You add them all together. And you might...
So what? Just thinking locally and state-based, right? Because we still, you know, what can local and state governments do now? And then what should the federal government be doing now? Let's keep in mind that if we had a federal government that wanted to do something.
Well, you know, I think even if we had a federal government that wanted to do something, there's not much it could do because there's no public support for it.
Mm.
And so the first thing we need to do is mobilize a new civil rights movement that involves not just understanding this history, that I've just described to you, but also that engages in the other kinds of mass action that civil rights movements have always had to engage in order to win victories. You know, we didn't win victories in the mid-20th century, whether it was lunch counters or buses or interstate transportation or public accommodations. We didn't win them just by telling people it was unconstitutional. We won them because it was a civil rights movement that was determined to force the country to abide by its constitutional responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So simply knowing the history that I've been describing to you is not going to be enough to get policymakers, even if they wanted to do something, to do it, because there's yet no public support or understanding of the constitutional imperative to do it. So I think the first thing we need to do is expand the education of this history. One of the things that you can do, and that anybody can do, is make sure that it's taught accurately in schools. I examined the textbooks that are used in every high school and middle school in the country, and I found that every one of them lies about the history that I've been describing to you.
Wow.
And every one of us has children or nieces or nephews or grandchildren in schools, and we have access to teachers and principals and superintendents and school board members. And we should be demanding that this history be accurately taught, because if the next generation doesn't know this history any better than ours have learned it, they'll be in as poor a position to remedy it as we've been. So I can describe all kinds of policies that the government could follow, but I think it's a mistake to think that the impediment to following them is the Trump administration. Even a liberal Democratic administration at this point would be able to do very little, because it hasn't yet built the popular support for it, and there's no civil rights movement that's forcing them to do it.
So
Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s was a great civil rights leader, but he was forced by a civil rights movement to become a great civil rights leader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in including, I guess, a policy plank, even if you said for well-meaning progressives who want to do something, there's first the education that needs to happen. And I think you do that with your book. And that's part of the reason why, you know, we wanted to have you here, is we, you know, explore for people the one of the reasons why I do this show is for people to understand the history and context, to sort of get that re-education that's not being taught in schools or that wasn't taught to us. This certainly wasn't an education that was taught to me in terms of how, you know, government was complicit in creating segregation in this country. So there's the first of the education. And then, as you mentioned, sort of mobilizing and creating an atmosphere that there is a will to do something, not only from elected officials, but also from the community overall. So have you seen any community-led actions that have been successful in educating and then mobilizing their communities to make change in say, local communities and governments?
Well, there are many communities that have enacted the progressive policies that attempt to desegregate. They're fairly modest. Because the really serious problems would need the backing of the federal government. But for example, New Jersey requires any developer to set aside a proportion of the units that the developer is creating for low-income and moderate-income families, so that every jurisdiction, the law, it's called a fair share law, mm-hmm. in every jurisdiction in the state, is required to move towards providing housing for a fair share of its broader metropolitan area's low-income population. That's a very good program. In Montgomery County, outside Washington, D.C., in Maryland, there's a program, a similar program, where not only do developers have to set aside, in this case, it's about 15% of their units for moderate income families, but then the Public Housing Authority of Montgomery County buys one third of that 15%, or 5% of the total units, for its public housing program. And so you can't tell the difference between a public housing unit and a unit for wealthy families. That's been a very, very successful program. So there are models of things that can be done, but for really a serious change, the two programs I described, for example, are excellent in terms of bringing some minority families into previously all-white segregated communities. but they don't do anything about the segregation that previously existed. And that requires much more aggressive action, and it requires more public support. And like I said, a civil rights movement. Mm-hmm.
Now, finally, just before I let you go, what, if anything, is then owed to, besides creating policies going forward that address this issue, is there anything owed to communities of color for what was done in the past?
Well, are you talking about reparations?
Yes.
Okay, well, I think to desegregate metropolitan areas, there are many policies you should follow, some of which will be cost-free and some of which will require expenditures. So, for example, to use the example I was giving you a few minutes ago, take the case of Levittown, where homes that were affordable to African Americans when they cost $100,000 are now unaffordable because they cost $600,000 or $500,000. Levittown, because of the Fair Housing Act, which prohibits future discrimination but did nothing to reverse the segregation that existed, because of the Fair Housing Act, Levittown now has an African American population that I think is about 2%. In a broader area where the African American population is about 15%. Well, if we really were committed, and we're not at this point, so I'm not suggesting this is a policy that we should go around talking and about, because it's not going to happen without more public support. But if we were really committed to desegregating, the federal government should buy up the next homes that come up for places like Levittown that may cost $500,000 on the open market, and then resell them to African Americans who are qualified for $100,000. Mm. That would be a narrowly targeted remedy for a specific constitutional violation. And if we understood this history, the courts would have to approve it. So that would require some expenditure of funds compensate African Americans for the fact that the federal government prohibited them effectively from accumulating wealth over the last few generations. But there are many policies that we should follow which wouldn't require expenditures of funds. And the ones that require expenditure of funds are not necessarily the most important. As I mentioned earlier, prohibiting suburbs from maintaining zoning ordinances that don't allow for modest income families to live in these suburbs should be seen as unconstitutional, and they should be prohibited, and prohibiting those kinds of zoning ordinances wouldn't cost the government a cent. Mm-hmm. So we need a mix of different kinds of policies, some of which would cost money, and you might call those reparations. I prefer to call them remedies, but I don't object to the term reparations. But some of them would be cost-free, and I think it's a mistake to get hung up on the ones that cost money and not understand that many of the more powerful ones wouldn't cost a thing.
So finally, our final question today, we have a number of people who are listeners to the show who, take action, from what we talk about here on the show. So what are mm-hmm. some things that, it seems like a large issue, and it is, but what are some things that you would say that an individual, whether they're, an activist in their community, we have a number of people listening, they're running for office for the first time, or they are an existing elected official, maybe in their local or state government. What are one or two concrete things that someone can take away from our conversation that they can immediately implement or immediately do to address this issue?
Well, the main one is one I talked about before. It's very modest, and the thing about it is that it's very powerful, but anybody can participate in it, and that is to challenge the way in which this history is taught in our schools. I guarantee you that if you challenge the way it's taught and talked about in the schools and taught in the schools, you'll start a conversation in the adult community as well. So that's the first thing. There are many policies that can be changed to make progress towards desegregation. We don't have time to talk about them now. I describe some of them, in a chapter of my book called Considering Fixes. The Section 8 voucher program, the low-income housing tax credit program, both of these reinforce and perpetuate segregation. Section 8 voucher holders are much more likely to be able to use those vouchers in already segregated neighborhoods than in middle-class communities. And in fact, a Section 8 voucher holder is more likely to have to live in a segregated community than a family with a similar low income who doesn't have a Section 8 voucher. So having a Section 8 voucher perpetuates and increases segregation. And the same thing is true of the low-income housing tax credit, which is a subsidy that a tax credit that the Federal Treasury Department gives to states for developers of low-income housing. And the states award these tax credits to developers who mostly build new housing for low-income families in already segregated neighborhoods, rather than in middle-class neighborhoods where the children would have better opportunities, where families would have more access to transportation and jobs. That is a very easy program to reform, but it requires political will, and public officials should demand that we reform it so that low-income housing tax credits are used for the purpose of integration rather than the purpose for segregation. Right now, those developments with the tax credits are almost entirely built in already segregated communities. The landlords love to do it that way because the land is cheaper there, and they don't have to hold a bunch of community meetings explaining why they're bringing poor people into the community. But that can easily be changed. We cannot award tax credits to developers who simply want to reinforce segregation.
Right. Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation. Certainly, there was a lot of interest in the book, and our book club discussed it. And I thank you for writing it. I thank you for continuing to have the conversation about it. And it'll continue to be on our website, and we'll put some additional reading material from the bibliography from the book as well. And so thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Sunday Civics. Visit our website at www.sundaycivics.org, where you can watch the full interviews of our guests, subscribe and download previous episodes, and much more. While you're there, be sure to check out our resources page for more information and tools on how to take civic action in your community. Join us next Sunday for another episode of Sunday Civics. Now go get civically engaged.